future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Everybody, welcome, welcome. Yes, here we are. It is Monday, November 15th, 2021. Can you believe it? It's almost Thanksgiving. It's blowing my mind every single day. Welcome to Raging Chickens, Out the Coop Live. This, of course, is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. On Out the Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts, right from our own backyards and from across the country. On Fridays, Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And you got to check out the Wednesday show with Cyril Michaleko. Cyril is a progressive columnist with the Bucks County Courier-Times and the Intelligencer. And he joins me to drill down into the Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and international politics. You got to throw that in too every once in a while, right? And you can help get all our shows by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. Just head on over to patreon.com/rcpress. And you can help out the show right now. Yep, just head on over to our YouTube channel if you're not there already. Smash that subscribe button, like the stream for this show, and hit that notification bell so you know every time that we go live. You can also sign up for our Discord server to continue the conversation well after the show is over. Just all the details of that are in tonight's show notes. And for more PA progressive talk, tune in to The Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern on his YouTube channel, Twitter. Look, wherever you're going to find a streaming, that's where Rick's going to be. So check him out. Best bet is to head on over to ricksmithshow.com for all the latest across his platforms. Have you heard me say before? I can't keep track of it. It's exploding. He's got a show in Los Angeles, KPFK. He's at WBAI in New York on the weekends. He's got the TV show on Free Speech TV. Head on over to The Rick Smith Show for all the latest. And you have, if you haven't already, I don't know what you're waiting for, but you got to check out the Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. Those amazing PA women stirring the political cauldron behind this podcast rock the house. And they know where the bodies are buried. Spooky, right? You betcha. Make sure to follow them on Twitter at The Night Caucus and subscribe to their podcast on Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. And attention for all you gamers out there. Check out the Game Inn. That's with two N's. The Game Inn is a Quakertown-based Black family-owned gaming store. They're friends of the show, and they've got everything for retro N64s, latest consoles, video games for all platforms, collectibles, action figures, Funko Pops. You get it. And look, we're back to school. Your kid gets an A on the report card. They take them on over to the Game Inn, and they get a discount on their purchase. Check them out on their Facebook page and follow them on Twitter at the Game Inn. That's with two N's. That's at the Game Inn on Twitter. Got a question about something that's hard to find, just shoot him an email at thegameinpa@gmail.com. And a special shout out goes to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at @songadayman. That's at @songadayman on Twitter. Quick programming note before we get into it tonight. Next Monday, November 22nd, we're going to change up our show a little bit, as you've heard me say. I'm going to be welcoming Gwen Marshall, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Florida International University. And we're going to be talking about her book, Ancestry and Culture, An Alternative to Race in 5e. What is 5e, you ask? Yes, it's the fifth edition of Dungeons & Dragons, of all things. Yes. It's a book that looks to bring to the world of tabletop role-playing games a more critical and dynamic understanding of race and culture. Really fantastic, award-winning book and compendium to the D&D stuff. All the more important as we saw an uptick in the number of people playing D&D, especially kids, and then aftermath of the pandemic. So to have this critical understanding of race being brought into that kind of gaming, especially a role-playing context, is phenomenal. So on today's show, I am super, super happy to welcome Dr. Laura Putnam to the show. Laura's a UCIS researcher of gender and migration in the modern Americas. Her interest in grassroots social movements has led her to local civic organizing in Pittsburgh's 11th Ward. She's also a member of the advisory board of the New Pennsylvania Project. Laura's Twitter account has become a must-follow for the people looking to understand elections in PA, the emergence of a strong progressive left movement in Western PA, and critical linkages between organizing and democratic politics. Well, tonight we're going to be talking about this month's elections beyond the initial hot takes and about the meaning and causes of the election results. And the background for our discussion tonight will be Laura's recent article, Rust Belt in Transition, What Has Happened in Pennsylvania's and the Entire Rust Belt's Middle Suburb Counties, and Can It Be Reversed? That was published last year in Democracy, a Journal of Ideas. And you got to follow Laura on Twitter, and that's at Laura, L-A-R-A underscore Putnam, P-U-T-N-A-M. You're going to find that in today's show notes. Make sure you follow her on Twitter. Do this. And nobody got to see, Laura, your reaction to when I said you're a must-follow Twitter thing. But welcome to the show.
Thank you. It is a delight to be here.
Yeah, and I do really mean that. I mean, I think that it was, I have to say, just initially, in the aftermath of, this month's elections, it was really, I think, really useful for me to be following how you were unpacking the numbers and ward by ward in the face of the kind of hot takes that we're seeing that wanted to read some sort of national script over what was going on, when the reality was everything was really complex. It gets more interesting by the day.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And it's, you know, it's even more so, these days, since with mail-in voting and with the disparity in the uptake of mail-in voting, where many Democrats are choosing to use mail-in voting, very few Republicans are doing so. What that means is that even on top of all the usual layers of complexity of interpreting statewide and down ballot results, it's also like we're just not going to know what the actual numbers are until multiple days after the election. And so, trying to get out the instinct of, I think, a lot of the, news media to jump out in front to begin analyzing literally before the votes that were already cast last week are counted can really get in the way of understanding, because once a narrative gets set, people have a really hard time rethinking what just happened.
Absolutely. And I mentioned this to you before the show, and we were talking before we went live. I mean, literally about a half an hour before we kind of got on, I got an email from Kirsten Zolfo, who was on the show last week. And if you remember, on the show, we talked about some of the really tight races in Bucks County. And she had mentioned the race in Newtown Township, where it looked like we were going to lose a Democratic seat there. And this is what she wrote to me before today's show. So last week, there was Ellen Schneider. She was running to be the newest Newtown Township supervisor of Democratic Party, and it looked like she was losing by double digits last week. Just today, this came in, is that it turns out she won by 6 votes. And that's, it just goes to show exactly what you were just saying, that kind of dynamic, is that we, even reading the elections and the results, is we have to be very, I guess, different in our approach and a little bit more patient before to really settle things out to figure out what's going on. So let's take a look at one of the reasons I was very excited to have you on the show is, like, as everybody knows, I've been kind of talking about your article, Rust Belt in Transition, that was published in Democracy, a Journal, last year, 2020. And it talks about some of the shift that has taken place about, both in union density and the kind of the rural-urban divide, in particular in their association with becoming, say, consistent or countable Democratic voters. So, and I thought it would be helpful for people to kind of see what's been going on, understand a little bit of that historical context first, and then bring us up to kind of where what's happening today and some of these shifts that are going on, and the ways that I think you talk about in the article as having to really understand each one of these areas is very fractured in terms of an electorate. So can you take us through what has happened, especially in some of these Rust Belt kind of middle suburbs or around, the Pittsburgh region that you focus on here, and the shift away from the Democratic Party?
Sure. So what I try to do, as I'm a historian, so I'm not actually in the business of hot takes. Like, Twitter sort of pushes me to give up-to-date reactions and to hear back from people, which is great. But what I do, in real life for a living is understand change over generations of time. And part of what's interesting to me about political shifts that are underway within Pennsylvania is that there are things that are happening over, over a long period of time. And there are other things that are happening, in real time that people can impact. So I'm always trying to do a little bit of saying, whoa, let's look at the bigger picture here and see some longer term trends. But that shouldn't make people feel like there's nothing they can do because it's just these inexorable demographic trends, because actually inexorable demographic trends are just the outcome of lots of little individual decisions adding up in the same direction. So even as I sort of pull back and say, here's the big picture, that shouldn't be telling folks who are listening to us, oh, you know, why even bother? It's beyond me. It's the contrary. The contrary is the message. Like, people make politics, right? And sometimes we do it in ways that we're aware of, and sometimes we do it in ways that are influenced by patterns that we don't even see, by shifts in employment patterns, by shifts in residence, and so on. And so part of what I try to capture in the article that you're describing is both some of the longer-term economic, social, and demographic changes that have pushed in the direction of turning areas that had been, you know, in the 1950s, 1960s, the stronghold of the Democratic Party within Pennsylvania. In those same places, folks have been moving away from the Democratic Party pretty steadily over the last two generations. And when I say folks, I mean the people who were there then. So I'm talking about the people who looked like what the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania looked like, you know, two generations ago. So that was often folks who were, you know, probably didn't have a college degree, probably had a good family-sustaining union job, often lived in a, you know, male-headed household, but might be folks with family background in Eastern Europe, in Ireland, in Italian. So this is sort of, you know, what sometimes ends up getting called the white working class. But there's a whole complexity to that, right?
Right.
But and in, you know, in places like Northeast PA, Southwest PA, there was a whole world built around factory towns, around a functioning industrial economy at its heyday, which it really was in the immediate, you know, post-World War II aftermath. We had a federal government working to support the steel industry and manufacturing, and working to support unions within those industries as a route to prosperity for folks who went into those factories and for their families. So you had, and being a good voting Democrat at that point was part of daily life in community after community. It wasn't just about a political identity. There were local Democratic clubs. There was someone who was the, you know, the person who was the head of your Democratic ward, probably called up and down the street every time there was an election, you know, touched base with people, reminded them to get out and vote. And there was a whole world of you know, faith-based organizations in, you know, clubs and lodges that were that worked together to pull people into, you know, community life and to make being part of the Democratic Party central to that community life. And so the pattern over the course then of the subsequent, you know, generation and a half has been of folks moving away from not just the party, but also from some of those same institutions that helped them feel part of and feel like their voice was heard within that broader party.
So let me ask you this. To what degree do we also see, it's really clear to me, and it was really clear in the article about when these, for lack of a better term, the kind of, say, social political infrastructure that forms around, you know, the culture around, say, the Democratic Party and, say, progressive politics, when that starts to fracture, when you start taking out things like, you know, people's well-being, like the steel industry. I grew up in Utica, New York, right? And I grew up, you know, kind of in the 70s and 80s when I watched all the major industry leave, right? And that was what sustained that. And I go back there now, and it is like my neighborhood is Trump flag from one side to the other. And that was not the case when I was growing up. And I see the similar kind of dynamics here. When once you remove that kind of infrastructure, the family sustaining wage, for example, the kind of the good union jobs, then everything else starts to fracture. And to what degree is at the same time, and this is something you don't really cover so much in the article, but do you get a sense of to what degree the Democratic Party itself is also kind of shifting in its identities during this period of time? Or is this more kind of really more of a function of the breakdown of that, you know, kind of almost material infrastructure that's girding that culture?
So I think it's both things at once. I mean, if you think about what's happened, if you like cast your mind back to the 1950s, early 1960s, that union, the fusion of basically like white working class Rust Belt you know, soon to be Rust Belt. It had not yet rusted. The rust was shiny. That was shiny metal. So the fusion of those like steel girders and the priorities and the language of the Democratic Party was so tight that it's always going to feel less so, right? So that in order for the Democratic Party to encompass and speak to the absolutely genuine and valid concerns of people, of a much broader range of people, which is what the Democratic Party subsequently from the 1960s onwards, as that Democratic Party, as that Democratic coalition is broadening, as the Democratic Party throws in with the civil rights movement and decides ultimately, you know, that it's not going to try to straddle segregation, and it's not going to try to encompass and support segregation. In some places, it's going to embrace moving America forward on the issue of civil rights and equal political participation for non-white people in this country. So, you know, that Democratic coalition has been expanding in the number of, in the range of, you know, partners and parties and allies within that coalition. And necessarily, that's going to mean that the topics that are at the front of what the Democratic Party statewide and nationwide has to be speaking to are not going to be that tight fit as they were back in the 1950s when this was the core, right? And so it's both that the Democratic Party sort of structurally, if you know, living in a country which, because of the way that the structure of, you know, first past the post election, the country that we live in is going to be, it's going to be basically a two-party structure, right? It's going to be a two-party government. So in a two-party system in which the Republican Party largely represents white, conservative white Christians, leaving the Democratic Party to largely represent a whole bunch of other stuff, like a wide variety of ideological positions, of ages, of people coming from different race, ethnicity, and so on, the Democratic Party is necessarily has a broader straddle, right? And so it has to be like the phrase "big tent" is sometimes used. But that if you're going to have a big tent, you can't just announce, "Okay, we're a big tent. Let's all sing."
We got a big tent.
Right. Like, here we are in the tent. Let's hug each other. Like, you know, like I have this image of the, you know, the parachutes that they play games with, and all the kids throw up the parachute and they tuck behind them, and then they sit down and we're like, "Oh, we're in this parachute together." Like, okay, maybe if you're, you know, if your kindergarten teacher got that to work, it's because you practiced and they gave you guidance.
Right.
You were like, "Okay, now we're lifting up our arms together and we're pulling it back together." Because you can't just make that work automatically, right? So it's sort of similarly with a political party. If you want to make that big tent work, you've got to do the work to create the structures through which people can talk to each other and listen to each other and come to build empathy for other people within that coalition. And if you don't do the work of creating that infrastructure, that social infrastructure, you should not be surprised when people run out the door of that tent.
100%. And I had this image of, you know, like in front of like used car lots, you got that little kind of floppy thing that's blowing up
gosh.
In there. Everything.
Literally, I know the one that you're talking about. Just over by Century 3.
That's what I think. It's like, that's not a plan, right? You know, so...
That's not a plan. That's exactly right.
And it also seems, it was striking to me as you're describing that too, is what I started thinking too, is it seems as the Republican Party has become kind of, has narrowed its focus. I mean, it's really become more homogeneous over the years to represent this really kind of white identity party. It seems like those exact things that you were talking about that are a problem for the Democrat right become easier for Republicans because they're really only speaking for one constituency. And the game is a very different one, which also helps to explain, I think, some of the reasons why their focus is so like steadfast on voting rights and maintaining power through all the kind of wielding the mechanisms of power and the legislature, where the Democrats really have a kind of social, political kind of engagement problem. Like, how do you actually build an organization that is not built around one singular identity?
Yeah, absolutely. And it matters that in these same years in which the Democratic Party is necessarily becoming more, so it's encompassing a broader range of urban, suburban constituencies, a broader range of ages and priorities, people who have, you know, legitimately different, potentially complementary, but legitimately different priorities. But in those same years, you know, basic working class life in the United States in its social and organizational level has just taken body blow after body blow. And that's true in sort of largely white working class areas. It's true in urban areas with largely, mm-hmm. Whose population may be largely people of color. So, and it's true in rural areas. It's true in some of the more challenged suburbs. So, and these include, the constant attacks on unions have been not only impactful, right. Legal attacks on the sort of relentless pursuit of making deep-pocketed funders on the political right of making it hard for working people to organize has been important not only for, wage levels and benefit levels and so on, but it has really deprived a generation of people in this country from the experience of sort of a school of democracy and a school of democratic right. participation, not capital D democratic participation, just small d democratic participation, a school for political participation, which is the role that unions have played for every immigrant group and for the working class exactly. traditionally within this country. Like it was that experience of, how do we come to work together? What should make me believe that my voice matters? And so we shouldn't be surprised that rates of voting and participation in elections, especially in off year, in non-presidential years, but in every year, have fallen among disadvantaged Americans, and that's been differentially impactful for the Democratic Party, which is trying to hold together this coalition, which is both getting more diverse and is resting in communities who don't necessarily have the strength of local civic institutions that they would have had a generation earlier or two generations earlier.
Yeah, and I found it fascinating. You've got this chart in the article where you're looking at, the correlation of countywide presidential vote margins, percentage of rural population and percentage of urban or union voters from 1980 to 2016 in Pennsylvania. And right around, say, 1997, 1998 is where these two lines cross, where the rural-urban divide is a much more stronger predictor, or the rural voter much predictor of what the presidential margins look like compared with union votes, where that just kind of drops off a cliff, too, as well. And you make this really interesting point that runs counter to some of the ways that people have interpreted the role that, say, Obama's election is like. Actually, he says that divide slowed when Obama was elected. That wasn't the kind of the moment at which these things went kind of like, in opposite directions. Actually, that tendency slowed when Obama seemed to have that kind of organized infrastructure. You make this great point about, he had something, in 40 of the 67 counties, there were kind of like grassroots on the ground offices, people working, working doors, doing the door-to-door organizing, which we haven't seen before. And that actually made a significant difference in terms of those dynamics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's because the reaction to Obama's election was indeed concentrated in, rural and ex-industrial areas, and the surge of the Tea Party in response to Obama's election was anchored in those places. I think it may be easy to falsely extrapolate from that and say, wow, the whole community around those Tea Party areas must have been opposed to Obama from the start. That's really not true. Now, if you look at the numbers, Obama was present and persuasive in many places where Democrats had been losing traction, right? And so he really slowed that rate of Democratic decline in presidential voting in Rust Belt areas in Pennsylvania and beyond Pennsylvania. And then Donald Trump sped it up, right? So it was sort of it's kind of as if we got a little bit like frozen in amber a little bit during Obama's period in office. And then Donald Trump, spoke the right language, hit the right notes, did, shifted away from some of the elite Republican sort of libertarian small government priorities, and spoke instead the language of sort of providing, good government benefits to the people who he defined as deserving them. And that really resonated in a lot of places, right? So he sort of sped up what had been those long trends that had slowed down, that polarization that had slowed down under Obama, then absolutely sped up in 2016, and then really hit down ballot as well. I mean, that's the other thing we haven't talked about yet, but so far we've been describing what we've been describing. You can see it happening at the presidential level, and you can also then in place after place see these political changes of sort of shifting identification happen first at the presidential level and then move down ballot, so that even, you know, even multiple cycles after, let's say, most folks in Southwest Pennsylvania, you know, were not voting for Democrats at the presidential level. They were, you know, Bill Clinton was the last Democrat they voted for, maybe. But they were still voting, you know, for Bob Casey for a while. And then even at the, you know, at the Senate level, maybe they were, there was no statewide office, no senator, U.S. senator was on the ballot for Democrats who they felt really spoke their language, really embodied their values, but they were still voting, you know, down ballot at the congressional level or the state Senate level or the state House level, or okay, at least like the county level, the folks who were the Democrats at the county level at least still resonated and seemed to them to merit their vote. And what we've seen in the last few years is at county level politics really realigning. So just following the same direction of what had been the movement already, you know, in multiple cycles before up ballot from those offices.
Well, and that's fascinating. And in some degree, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, there's that other piece that you wrote, like on postcards and superpowers, when you're talking about, you know, like I love that one too, in The Forge. It's a great that's a great article too as well. And the point you make in there is that the importance of social relationships as the basis of organizing. And it would make sense that takes a little bit longer to break down at the community level, even if it's broken down at the national level, because you're actually talking about people that you're involved when you have relationships built within your neighborhoods, your community, your churches, and all the other stuff. And it seems like, you know, I want to make sure we have time to talk about what happened here on in the elections. But this shift with Trump, right? I mean, there's a couple things that the dynamics that are going on, and I'll let you kind of unpack it a little better than I can, certainly. On the one hand, you talk about this, you know, this dynamic, this shift that's going on, that we see a whole bunch of things happen at once, it seems, in the election of Donald Trump and the aftermath of that. Number one is that we see this kind of like, you know, this upsurge of this, well, let me call it, say, radical right, or the Trump hits the right notes. And now we see the kind of shift in terms of what people are, how people are identifying themselves. But then you also see this, you know, coming to life in these ring suburbs, right? In these more kind of professional, affluent suburbs, dominated in many, like, as you say, by women doing the organizing on the ground in those spaces. And seeing this kind of birth of another, what I would look at as another kind of source of power and organization within the Democratic politics, which in the end, in my way, it seems like it doesn't make everything easier. In some ways, it makes it even more complicated because now you have these new constituencies. So maybe you could take us a little bit into that dynamic and that shift and what's happening with the rise of Trump and then afterwards. And then we'll kind of get to where we sit right now and what do you see happening on the ground, the organizing that's happening there?
Sure. So one thing that we see happen is that with the election of Donald Trump, we saw nationwide a surge of new civic engagement on the broad center to left among, especially concentrated among women, although not only women, often people who had been sort of community insiders, but political outsiders. They had been members of their local library board, or they had been, you know, it's the PTA moms, or it's the grandmothers who, you know, when they were, you know, who were retired from having been a principal or a librarian, and who were involved in their community, but for whom politics, like electoral politics, had not necessarily been, and particularly like local electoral politics, that was someone else's problem, right? And you know, in place after place, the women we interviewed say, you know, Donald Trump was elected, and I never thought that could happen in this country, and I thought that this is not the country that I want for my children. So for a lot of these women, and these were disproportionately college-educated women and disproportionately white women. Now, that's not because women of color were not paying attention to politics, but you had very many fewer, let's say, African-American women looking at Donald Trump's election and saying, I never thought that could happen in the United States. Women of color have a very different experience of American politics, of how racism works, of how present it is or isn't. So there was, you heard, concern and, dedication to action, but you did not hear shock from, right. from most, from people who are differently situated by their own life experiences. But for relatively privileged, generally white, well-educated women, this was for many, many described it as like a, cold water in the face. And so women of that particular demographic cohort and that particular demographic profile sort of stepped into politics wherever they were. And one thing which was really striking in our research is that even though the voices nationally saying, take action, here's what you can do, here's the Women's March, here's Indivisible, and most of those voices were really focused on national level events, call your congressman, call your senator. But in place after place, what we saw was immediately within weeks, certainly by February, March of 2017, people were already identifying local offices that they could contest. And often in their, purple suburbs, red suburbs, Republicans had been winning everything since forever. Everyone, the only people who ran for school board ran as Republicans. Republicans had, long dominated the courts, even in, places like Montgomery County, Delaware County, and the suburbs north and south of the city of Pittsburgh that have similar demographic profiles. There just wasn't an organized Democratic presence in those places. And folks stepped forward and started running for office, recruiting people to run for these very down ballot offices, and really created a new anchor for all kinds of potential new political alliances that hadn't been there. Because if we remember, like we described what the old Democratic Party in Pennsylvania, and especially in Northeast Pennsylvania, Southwest Pennsylvania, looked like, it was anchored in the building trades, anchored in more most of the local elected officials 10 years ago who were Democrats in these areas were, aging white men, right? Who looked like the Democratic Party had looked like within their locality 20, 40 years earlier and didn't look like today's Democratic Party. Now, some of them working very hard, some of them super connected. So I'm not dissing them at all, but I'm saying there were all sorts of pieces of the modern Democratic Party coalition nationally that were present. There were people of color within that community who were not getting represented within the local Democratic Party. There were college-educated women within that community who were not finding themselves showing up at a Democratic Party committee meeting, right? So the surge of new people has had, even when the new people who've stepped into politics and political action has actually been demographically very similar across very different places, the impact has actually been very different because what's going on locally in that place politically is different. So expanding the amount of progressive political energy in a place like the city of Pittsburgh has a very different set of knock-on results than expanding the amount of progressive political energy brought by the same, librarian women in the northern suburbs of the city of Pittsburgh and so on. So, and that's what we've been watching play out over the last, 4 or 5 years in Pennsylvania.
Well, I think it's absolutely fascinating. And the stories that I hear again and again and again, in particular for women who now are, say, running chapters of Indivisible, running chapters of even DSA, Democratic Socialist America, running chapters of, a whole bunch of PA Stands Up, for example, that are doing all this work. There's so many times there's a story that starts with, I wasn't political, or I grew up as a Republican, and this was a wake-up call. And the character of the organizing, and I don't want to overgeneralize here, but I mean, the character of just from, people within my social circle and beyond and friends of friends, it seems to have a very, I say in some cases, there seems to be a very strong kind of ideological push. Like we see this is clearly progressive left. But in other areas, it's non-ideological. It has to do with people's lives, right, and their kids and their community, and thinking about what they want their community to look like and seeing it not reflected in there. I mean, how do you see that those lines playing out for the organizational stuff that's non-ideological and the stuff that is more rooted in, say, more progressive or kind of left traditions?
I mean, we've seen both of those are real currents within different places. And so it's both the case that, some of the people who stepped forward and got extra involved after the election of Donald Trump you know, were folks with a whose theory of change for the electorate really depended on progressive policy implementation as, you know, what they see as essential to move the U.S. forward. But that, I would say there was less change. That was less of a new development. I mean, that was, you know, Bernie Sanders was capitalizing on folks who felt that way and carrying them forward as well. But that's somewhat distinct from the numbers of people for whom Donald Trump, what just it, the fact that Donald Trump could be elected exemplified for them that, that there's something broken in the system. And okay. So they, and these are, again, you know, sort of characteristically, you know, women who had a long history of working within systems. You know, these are women, often women of a generation that was the first generation of women to become leaders within their, you know, businesses or nonprofit sector or social service organizations. So they know all about working within systems and navigating, you know, male-run systems that are not working well. And it's kind of like they suddenly woke up and they're like, oh, politics is one of those systems. You know, this is, oh, this is the this yet another institution where, like, you know, some of the men in charge have made a real mess of things and left a lot of work for us women to clean up. And these are also, you know, characteristically, it was women who knew how to build those relationships and knew that building relationships was critical in order to put in place a better functioning, more transparent system. And that's not the only thing that's been happening in politics. But again, that's created possibilities for new kinds of alliances and for new kinds of leadership by people who don't look like them. So it's not just that, you know, this is not a story of Pennsylvania politics for the last 4 years in which it's like white women in the suburbs are the only ones who are doing things. On the contrary, what's really striking is what a diverse range of new kinds of leadership have been made possible once you've got a broader range of people paying attention to local and regional and county level politics.
100%. I mean, and the number of times I've heard people say, like, you know, especially, you know, again, women in these kind of key organizing positions say, well, you know, asking them, how is it that you started this? And they're like, well, I had the email list or I had the phone tree, right? Absolutely. I organized the bake sale at the school and I knew how to get in touch with everybody. It was like literally the whole infrastructure being shifted from, you know, this keeping the community functioning, right? Yeah. To like, wait a minute, let's exercise our power.
Yep. Yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly.
So to kind of to take the bridge to where it gets to the election here, one of the things that the story that you tell at one point of Darcelle Slappy as you know, and again, I'm cautious about wanting one person's experience translate into all these other races. But the idea about getting involved in a race and continuing the organizing over time, and the quote that you say, you know, at one point you say, you know, look, what SEIU organizers kept on telling you, say, elections lay tracks. Can you give us that little sense of like Darcelle Slappy's case? And then let's talk, then from there, we'll talk a little bit about like what just took place and what you see as some of the, you know, the lay of the land right now and what this might mean going forward. Yeah.
Sure. So the example of the race that Darcelle Slappy ran in, she ran for a state house district in that encompasses part of Beaver County and sort of moves north. It's one of these gerrymandered districts. And she was recruited to run for that office by a coalition that really represents this mixture of newcomers to the political process, finding alliances with folks who'd been doing the work for a long time. So you had, you know, folks in a group called Beaver County Voice for Change working alongside some people who'd been part of a sort of local Bernie supporters and Progressive Democrats of America, working alongside members of the NAACP, working alongside some leaders of some ministers within the African American community, coming together to say, you know, we want there to be an alternative to the Republican on the ballot in this state house district. And so Darcelle actually ended up running and being recruited to run as a Green candidate because there had been a trouble with getting the signatures to get a Democrat onto the ballot earlier. And so the coalition that had recruited her, you know, found someone. So Darcelle is someone who everyone in you know, that part of Western PA knows, among other things, because she was a referee for girls basketball games for high school basketball games for a long time, right? So one of these people who's just been a central part of the community who everyone knows, And so, you know, they worked hard to try to get Darcel elected. Didn't come close. That shouldn't surprise anyone. It's hard to get elected as a Green in a, you know, in a district that is, you know, all in for Donald Trump. But those relationships that were built, built forwards, right? And so the, you know, having that, the knowledge and capacity that was built from everything around, like, well, when do we need to start recruiting a candidate so we don't run into the signature gathering problem that we ran into before, to the working relationships between this, what I've already described to you, it's a pretty disparate coalition, folks who had different, you know, different life experiences, different degrees of suspicion about, you know, who these new allies showing up might be. So it's kind of like, I think of it as like, what's the infrastructure that's necessary to keep that big tent up? You know, we were, just as we were just talking about, to build up the capacity to know who to talk to and how to talk to them and what questions need to be asked in order to work together. That's muscle, right? You have to build up that muscle. Yeah. And if you, and those, so those social connections, when you use them, you make them stronger, right? As opposed to like cash, you use cash, you don't have it anymore. But social connections are a kind of resource, which like muscle, when you use it, it gets stronger. And you can just see that happening in the case of local, the local bottom-up rebuilding of a Democratic Party presence that's not going to look like the old Democratic Party presence necessarily in places like, you know, Beaver County, Beaver Falls. So after Darcel's race in 2020, a woman named Colby Cole, also a, you know, social worker, activist, African-American woman from Beaver Falls, ran a, you know, a campaign really in the midst of the pandemic focused on helping people learn how to vote and navigate the craziness of pandemic era mail-in voting. She fell short in the final count, but she too, she did not, you know, throw in her chips and say, oh, well, and walk away. She actually has stayed involved. She founded a new super mini PAC called, I think, New Voices PAC. And she helped then recruit and prepare other women to run for office. And someone named Kenya Johns was just elected mayor of Beaver Falls. She's the first African-American and first woman to be mayor of Beaver Falls. So it's a real, you know, a real example of how that, that slow process of building up the connections through which local politics can be very slowly transformed.
And I think it's very helpful to just see that timeline and for people to kind of, you know, okay, this is a trajectory. Like, this, nothing is random here. These are building and like exercising these muscles over time. And to see that, you know, we need a vision that goes beyond the single election in order to understand how we win, right? I think is critical. You know, and I was telling you a little bit about this beforehand, and that story resonated so much with me about what we're seeing here in Bucks County around school districts. I mean, we've had, I mean, literally, we've got freaking QAnon people that were just voted to the school board of my kid's school district, our school district. And it's like disturbing as all hell. But this is the second round of candidates organizing, right? Doing the door knocking, building relationships, and they caught up a little bit more. They gained more ground this time around. And the organization was absolutely like amazing to see on the ground. And so part of what, you know, was, which, and I shared this with you too as well, that I shared your article, both that one and the kind of the postcards article, say, look, this, everyone here is doing exactly what everyone needs to do, right? And doing amazing work. And that's happening like all over the state, as you said. So on election day this year, initially the narrative that came out was that huge Democratic losses, right? Like right across the board. And this is like, you know, this national narrative being pushed down to the local level. But it seems like each day that it passes, that the picture of what has happened, particularly in Pennsylvania, right, is not that narrative. Right. And I will say thank you for the work that you've been doing on Twitter to kind of like slowly unpack some of that stuff. So maybe just a little bit of, say, election reflection at this point. So we got some of the context in the history here. When you're looking back at these elections and seeing what happened on the ground, how do you kind of suss out how to read what's happening?
So I think part of the reason it's complicated is that there are different stories that are visible at different scales. So different offices are capturing like important political trends that are running in slightly contrary directions, right? So the movement of basically like rural and Rust Belt Pennsylvania, on balance, away from strong identification with the Democrats and towards baseline strong identification with Republicans, that is well underway. And nothing, you know, and the election of Donald Trump actually, you know, ratcheted that up. And nothing that's happened since 2016 has made that, you know, core shift in identification reverse. And it's, you know, it's again, it's part of the those long-term economic, demographic, and organizational patterns that we were talking about at the beginning, the decline of unions and mm-hmm. shifts in the media environment as well. So the surge in first right-wing radio, talk radio, and then Fox News Today, along with the coalescing of evangelical Christian congregations into alignment with the Republican Party specifically, all of those things are sort of undergirding that long-term, you know, shift and that polarization between more rural areas and more urban areas, which have and the sort of inner suburbs that have, which are, tend to be more economically dynamic, more cosmopolitan because new people move to them from out of state and from out of the country, more diverse. All of those, so that you have the more cosmopolitan suburbs moving towards firmer alignment with the Democrats, and one of the questions, sort of, where is, you know, where are the exurbs going to fall in the line in between? Mm-hmm. So there's this geographic realignment that's going on, and that has been actually at the presidential level accelerated with Donald Trump, and then actually slowed a little bit with Joe Biden, who I think, you know, Scranton Joe does resonate with some folks who might have been pretty skeptical of Hillary Clinton and might be pretty skeptical mm-hmm. of whoever the next Democratic presidential candidate was. But like Joe Biden felt like maybe he got it, or maybe, you know, he wasn't too scary. But if you look down ballot, you see that actually 2020 was a year in which for down ballot statewide Democratic candidates, it was a year in which they lost all kinds of places they hadn't lost before.
Yeah.
And so that steady movement down ballot of this realignment is continuing. But what's running counter to that is at the local level, because you've got these, you know, a new generation, not necessarily of young people, but a new generation of activists, decent numbers of them in their 60s and 70s, but newly involved in new ways and making alliances with younger people and people who don't look just like them and so on, becoming increasingly professional in all the good ways in terms of how they're running campaigns locally. So, and that's, I think, part of the reason that we saw so many races, school board races, town council races that were contested and that came down to like single digit divides. But there were so many races that were close enough that before the, not just the mail-in ballots finished counting, before the provisionals finished counting, it looked like they were going to go to Republicans, and then all the provisionals came in. The provisionals were, in most places, about like 7 points less Democratic than the leaning than mail-in ballots, but they were definitely provisionals almost everywhere fell pretty heavily for Democrats, and so provisionals were able to push Democratic candidates just over the line. Even you told the story of Newtown, but we've seen the same thing happened in Hampton, here in the Pittsburgh area, in the North Hill School District. So a bunch of different places, races were that close. I don't think that's happenstance. It's because you had people actually doing door knocking, vote counting, in some cases strike lists, like measuring how close they were going to get, strategizing, pouring in the, you know, the effort in order to, and being much savvier than they could have been, than they would have been 2 or 4 years ago, about where they could get the resources that they might need to get if they could make the case that they were plausibly within striking distance of winning. So you had all these local races. It became possible for people to push it to being competitive or just beyond competitive and actually winning. And that's really important. Like that, even if that doesn't change who won the Supreme Court race, right?
Right.
So in the short term, it has an impact in those local races, which is going to have a huge impact on things like, you know, what the politics of the books on the library shelves for your kids in the public school are, right? Like they're going to be like school boards make all kinds of decisions about, you know, what the superintendent can and can't do, what teachers can and can't do. So there are going to be immediate, you know, life material consequences, but also there are longer term political consequences to having had that kind of sort of pushing downward of concrete experience in how to run an effective and savvy campaigns. And that's what I saw happening in place after place. Some of these, the folks who were just, again, political outsiders in 2017, as they were just kind of throwing everything at the wall to see what would stick in terms of running local campaigns, you know, very passionate, very inexperienced, for that very reason, in some cases, doing smarter things than the, you know, the political pros who had their own, like,
absolutely
supposedly savvy toolkit that they just pull out of the box and they're like, okay, knock this many doors, yard signs don't vote, you know, here's what we do, here's what I, you know, here's what all the other, all the other consultants tell me to do, and so here's what I'm passing on to you.
Right.
I'm seeing you have some experience of this.
Oh, those people drive me insane. And I think, and it, for me, it's like one of the best things to come out of the last two election cycles, right? Well, ever since 2020 and this kind of rebirth of organization, is that people like doing the organizing themselves. And when these kind of like talking heads consultants start coming in saying their nonsense, they just kind of like kind of nod politely and just kind of get back to business because you recognize they're not doing it. And, you know, and I think that what you make me think of is that, you know, moving forward, it's really the emphasis. I tell me if I'm being fair about, you know, about reading, taking away from what you've said, is that the move forward is, say, more about organizing than it is about, say, ideological right work. It's about the kind of the mechanics of organizing, like you said, that where unions have been the schools of doing the work of exercising the democratic muscles. That's really where, say, resources and time really needs to be spent if we're going to see this this kind of counter to that right wing shift.
Yeah, I think that's right. And one thing which is striking is that, you know, there's some kinds of scaling up that just individual local grassroots groups are just never, even when they're reaching out and, you know, finding new allies to work on issues that are locally crucial, whether it's environmental or criminal justice or et cetera, there's some kinds of scaling up that they're not going to be able to do, right? But what one thing which is interesting is how this organizing in several places, you can see new synergies emerging with, among other things, union organizing. So, you know, it's not happenstance that in Southwest Pennsylvania, the efforts to organize hospital workers, efforts by SEIU and others to unionize home healthcare workers and to unionize the UPMC workforce are moving forward now. They're gaining speed. The faculty of the University of Pittsburgh just voted to unionize this fall with the steelworkers. So there are potential synergies between this new electoral activism, creating spaces and connections and understanding that can then spill over into bringing into office elected officials who are much more open to finding new partnerships with new union partners, right? So maybe they're not coming into office as closely aligned, let's say, with the building trades, but that maybe they're coming into office with more potential connections and synergies to folks focused on organizing service sector workers and folks focused on organizing, you know, workers in the healthcare sector who've been excluded from labor protections. And so the unionizing campaigns that can be made possible by the changes in the electoral landscape can themselves then bring new people into the process of active civic engagement of having unions play that role of being, as I said, a sort of a school for small d democracy, which is what they has traditionally been so critical in this country. So that's, I think, if you want to tell an optimistic story about what we've seen happening up to and through November 2021 in Pennsylvania, it's that you can see happening, you know, in small scale, but in ways that are potentially quite important, new synergies between the progressive anti-Trump grassroots, where they've gone in life, and the possibilities of broader labor organizing.
Well, that's a phenomenal way to leave it on the optimistic note tonight. I've already kept you longer than I swear to God. Listen, I did not plan this, but this is why I wanted to close out with this little announcement here too, as well. Exactly to Laura's point, Tomorrow night at the Kutztown University campus, there's a rally with the Kutztown University Dining Workers United, who are in the process of unionizing. They're the only food service workers in the entire state system of higher education without a union. They are organizing, and Aramark was, they looked like initially that they were going to allow them to give voluntary recognition, voluntarily recognize the union. That didn't happen. It looks like the university administration has had something to say about this, perhaps. So these dining workers now are going to be rallying in front of the South Dining Hall tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. from the South Dining Hall. If you are in the Kutztown University area, this is a perfect example why we show up for workers, right? We show up for those workers at the dining hall and to those organizing efforts that are happening in our communities in sectors that are looking different than we are kind of normally see. And like you said, in the service sector. So I can't think of a better segue than that, Laura. you just set us up
for it. We planned it. We did not plan that.
I was like, you got to be kidding me. This is awesome.
It's just actually true. These things, what we are describing really is happening in lots of different places.
Absolutely. Well, listen, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm sorry to keep you a little longer than I promised initially. And like I said, you got to get out there, everybody. Please follow Laura on Twitter. It's at L-A-R-A, Laura, L-A-R-A underscore Putnam, P-U-T-N-A-M. Great kind of work there. And not just the stuff you do on election stuff. I mean, I think your work kind of more broadly is like, you know, this is a nice thing. It's been a nice way into your other work too as well. I've been following like, what else has she written? So I'm going to read it around. So it's phenomenal. Well, thank you for taking the time out for us tonight. And I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you so much. It's been a joy to be here.
All right, you got it. Okay, hey, everybody, we're going to take a little quick break, and we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to come back on there with some closing thoughts. If there's any things that you want to throw into the chat for folks who want to kind of call in, you got something to say, you want to hit us up on Riverside, make sure you head on over to the Riverside. Information on that is in tonight's show notes on our YouTube channel. Make sure that you shut off your volume on your YouTube before you kind of call into Riverside, just like you would any radio show, or otherwise you're going to get a bunch of feedback and everything else. But once again, Laura Putnam, Dr. Laura Putnam at University of Pittsburgh History Department, and amazing Twitter personality. That's how I had to throw it in. please check it out. Thanks again for joining us tonight. All right, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We're going to take this quick break. We'll be right back right after this. If I can get the volume to work right on my little show notes break. Hold on just a second. Watch this. See how I'm kind of pausing? Here we go. We'll be back right after this little quick break. Hey, everybody, everybody. Welcome back. Welcome back. It's Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Thank you. Sorry about that. I didn't have my my mic turned back on. Sorry about that. Welcome back, everybody. This is Raging Chicken's Out the Coop live. And this is one of the kind of glories of this separate part, is I always end up having a little technical problem. Frankly, I was just excited. You know, to close that discussion with Laura Putnam on organizing and supporting labor organizing and getting out there and showing up and seeing how these new coalitions develop was, I mean, I can't think of a better kind of transition to this rally that's going to be taking place tomorrow at South Dining Hall at Kutztown University's campus. This is the workers for Kutztown University Dining Workers United. They're demanding that KU and Aramark recognize their union. If you can make it out to Kutztown tomorrow at 5:30, be there. Show up a little bit early. Can't hurt. You never know what might be going on. So do check that out. A couple things that I just want to kind of go back on, and this is one of these shows where I really had to try to stay focused, because there was so much that I wanted to talk to Laura Putnam about, but we wanted to really stay close to what she was doing with that article, and then what's happening kind of down belt in some of these races. It's been pretty remarkable. You know, one of the things that I didn't get a chance to say in tonight's show too, as well, is exactly what she was pointing to about, like, you know, people staying with the organizing. Shortly before the show tonight too, as well, I've already talked about the Newtown situation, but shortly before the show tonight, one of these Facebook groups that I'm in around kind of school districts in Bucks County. There was somebody who said like, hey, there's a Penridge school board meeting tonight. And there's Penridge, that's probably still going on right now, a Penridge school board meeting tonight. And so somebody else made a post that said, oh, look, this is what they did at Central Bucks school district to make sure that they kind of understood what was going on and making sure they had a record of what was happening. This is what they did over there. To almost immediately afterwards, someone else who was part of the group said, oh, we already have a sign up sheet with that job kind of specified, right? So it was like, that's the kind of like, you know, social movement building muscles that are being exercised, is those kind of particular skills for doing democracy and kind of, you know, gaining power. Right. And I don't mean like gaining as in power over, but in that power with, right, with the community to say, look, we are not going to, you know, let this stand. And to see also that, you know, people in the Penridge School District tonight, you know, after kind of losing the election, right, and doing amazing organizing, like the response wasn't like, oh, well, I guess we're stuck with it. Nope. They were making sure that people were showing up, making sure that the struggle didn't end. As a matter of fact, there's going to be a celebration about the election coming up. They're doing all this kind of infrastructure building in order to ensure that this organizing only continues into 2022, 2023, 2024, right around. It's really, really impressive. And it's also been impressive to see, you know, these different school board organizations. Sometimes they're, you know, particular candidates and what happened in their particular campaigns. And sometimes it's, you know, a little bit bigger organization, like, you know, like here in Penridge, there's a Penridge United. And this is the second round of school board elections in which there's been a slate of candidates with Penridge United as a building out that organization. And now you have these different parent groups, right? Also, I should say parent is really the wrong word, because it's not just parents. It's parents, it's community members, it's people that are involved and saying, listen, we've got to stop this. We cannot allow our community to go down this road. And now they're talking to each other. I shouldn't say now, because they've already been talking to each other. And now there's those bigger questions about how do we build an organization that, to speak what Laura Putnam said, that could scale up a little bit. And, you know, the problem we have here in Bucks County, I mean, not to make everything about Bucks County, but the problem we have here in Bucks County is that there's that disconnect between those organizations that, you know, fund, like, say, congressional races and things like this, and these on the ground groups. And one of the things in Laura Putnam's article, The Rust Belt and Transition, she talks about that, you know, these candidates, these Democratic candidates are the kind of the fly-in candidates where, you know, suddenly there's a big mobilization of cash around a particular candidate for a particular race. That, as she said in tonight's interview, you know, once you spend that money, it's gone. Right. And so, and there's nothing that's left behind, you know, I mean, people might have got a few extra dollars in their pockets or things like this, but once that money's gone, it's spent. And so this model of kind of, you know, running Democratic Party candidates in a county like Bucks County, right, that are being kind of like, you know, supported by some sort of Democratic consultants someplace else, dropped into the here, and then having some sort of organization pop up like a pop-up shop, right, around the election with a bunch of money to try to kind of support this candidate. And then, you know, election's over, pop-up shop closes, they're gone, the money's gone, and then you're back to square one again, right? That model of how we can test elections at, you know, at the county level, at the district level, runs counter to the kind of organizational models that Laura Putnam was talking about tonight, where these social relationships, these kind of networks of you know, relationships that are built in this grassroots organizing effort moving up. And that's really, I think, is going to be the question moving forward. I mean, it's going to take... One of the things I do have to say, I should read this part to you directly from her piece. She kind of closes with this in this article. Did I lose the page? Let me see. Of course I lost the page. She makes this point. sorry. Here we go. So, okay, what this adds up to are regions that aren't, quote, coming back to Democrats in their top-line vote totals anytime soon. Not because the Rust Belt is a political monolith, but because it isn't. Each county is internally diverse in consistent ways, with moving parts headed in opposite directions. The new Democratic coalitions whose outlines are emerging are both awkward and incipient. And for now, they are not growing fast enough to compensate for the final crumbling of the old one around them. Right? The idea there is, I don't know how you hear that, but I hear that with a whole lot of hope. Right? There's something about reading that piece and having it acknowledged that there is really good work going on, but it's not catching up fast enough. So what does that mean? It means that we might lose a couple rounds of elections in some places, right? But that's not because it's the wrong kind of organizing. It doesn't mean that the district is too conservative, whatever the hell that means these days. What it means is that there's these dynamics that were set in motion well before today, right? Or last week or last year. And it's going to take a while to turn that ship, especially since we're talking about exercising political muscles that we haven't had to exercise, like, as communities for quite some time, right? And look, and I am the last person in the world that would ever say that, like, no one's been doing this work. There have been people who've been organizing, who've been, like, doing the good work for, you know, decades, right? That even as union density dropped off and that kind of infrastructure of democracy started to crumble around us, they continued to do the work, right? And, you know, there's this thing in social movements where, you know, Rick Smith once said this to me, and it's a little bit different context, but he was talking about, you know, doing labor radio, right? Doing labor media. And we were talking about, say, you know, the need to build out a kind of progressive media infrastructure in Pennsylvania. And this is like years ago. And there's a frustration that comes along with doing this week after week. When, you know, look, I mean, it's a side hustle, if you want to say, put it like that. So although it's not a hustle, I mean, I don't make any money from this. Right? It's like the idea is that you continue to do this in the hopes that at some point, to use Rick's words, you stay in the room long enough. At some point, someone's going to notice. Right. And then somebody will be there to meet up. And that's what's happened to his show right now. He's continued to do that work. And if he hadn't been doing that work every day for years, the kind of success he's having right now, you know, in terms of getting on platforms of WBAI, getting on KPFK, having the Free Speech TV show on Saturdays, if he had not been doing that and exercising those muscles for all that time, all that stuff that I just said wouldn't exist now. But that kept doing it. And some, you know, there's dark days when you do it like this. I mean, there's days when I'm sitting here with this, doing this show. I mean, I love this. This is literally like my church, right? I mean, the places where, you know, where I come to feel connected, right? To feel like I can just kind of talk and have people on that kind of help me think about stuff, right? And hopefully help you think about stuff. Right? To highlight things that are going on in the community with the hopes that it's going to have some kind of difference, right? For hope, there's going to be, you know, some impact, right? And, you know, all that kind of stuff. And the same thing is happening at these, you know, at these school board levels, at the district level, the municipal level, where people are doing this organizing. And it may take a little time to build that capacity, right? Or to go on scale. And for, you know, these more funding organizations to kind of get in sync with where the community's at, right? Where the good organizing is. You should go back and listen to the Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast this past week and the week before, where they talk about some of this stuff too. Earlier today, I was talking to Sean Kitchen about this. You know, it's just so funny. Sometimes things line up like this, where I've been thinking a lot about, you know, this key push about getting back to normal and so on. Right. And I just been thinking about what this means and how that the getting back to normal stuff doesn't seem to have the same kind of legs that it did even about 4 months ago. Right. And I think that's because of the experience of, quote unquote, getting back to normal has not panned out right in the way that we were promised. Right. So, yeah, it didn't pan out. I'm sorry, I just got distracted for a second. So I was listening to, you know, their podcast, and it was like, yeah, right. That same kind of idea about this disconnect from like the people who normally fund the organizational outlook are not necessarily there yet in terms of understanding the importance of investing in this infrastructure building the organization. Right. And in part, and I think, you know, I hadn't thought about it like this until I talked to Laura Pundham tonight, but to some degree, those funding organizations are having the same kind of trouble in terms of recognizing who are the leaders and where the power for winning lies. And in the most direct and simple case, it's because those old white guys who were sitting around smoking cigars and they were the kind of had the Democratic Party machines are not the ones that we should need to be investing in now. It's exactly those women. It's in the kind of the people of color in those kind of like, you know, who've been organizing on the ground that needs to be built out. And it's not like these consultants or the organization should come in and take over or think they can run. No, they just need to help them grow and ask those organizations what they need. Right. So anyways, you know, do check out Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. Check out the last two. Check them all out, obviously. But the last two podcasts in particular, I think, resonate with a lot of some of the things we're talking about here. So good. Paul asks, what is Laura's Twitter handle again? I'll give it to you. I'll put it right here. Lara underscore Putnam. That's it right there. I want to give an apology to Caitlin. Caitlin, I didn't get the notification when Laura Putnam was on, but Caitlin asked the question. During the summer of 2020, we saw many Black Lives Matter rallies in rural Pennsylvania, places like Lock Haven, Watsontown, Shamokin here in central PA. Did this have any effect on the elections? Was there any effort by the Democratic Party to channel that energy into votes? That's a phenomenal question. And I'll tell you what, I'll pose that question to her. I'm going to copy that out right now. And my apologies, Caitlin, for not seeing that one. Laura Putnam was still on the show tonight, but I appreciate it. And I will pass that on. And then on our show this Wednesday, Cyril and I will be back for the Wednesday show. If I hear back from Laura before then I will post that there. At the very least, we'll talk about it on Friday when Sean Kitchen and I come back for our weekly politics roundup. Great, excellent question. This is one of the things that I've told this story before. About, you know, there was one time that in Harrisburg, there used to be this Progressive Summit, right? The PA Progressive Summit, and Keystone Progress used to run it. And Keystone Progress is a very different organization now than it used to be. But it's, you know, it was kind of like a coming together of whatever, progressive organizations. You know, there'd be tables and there'd be breakout sessions and organizing and things like this. And, you know, it was, for me, you know, Raging Chicken. As Raging Chicken, we used to go there. We used to have a table there. It was a great place to meet folks across the state, see what was actually happening across the state. But as people kind of pointed out, it was decidedly whiter than where the organizing was happening. There was a certain kind of old school structure to it, right? And so, you know, that organization decided to, you know, put the more, you know, make it more of an organizing, which is makes total sense, right? Anyways, that was not the point that I was going to say. So there was one time, I was probably, you know, it was years ago, and a friend of ours, ours being Sean and I's, Sean Kitchen and I's, we were just going to go out after kind of one of these sessions. There's some kind of debate or something. We're going to go out afterwards. And we went with this friend of ours, and that friend had to go and pick something up, stop by an office that was close to where the conference was. You know, this person worked and did political work, and had worked for some organizations in there, and said, "Hey, you guys want to see something?" And he took us to this office, and there was a big map on the wall. Right. And it was, you know, somebody who does like an organization does some work with Democratic Party politics and stuff. And there was like different colors and there were pins and all that kind of stuff. And he said, "Do you see these, you know, see where there's those, like black spots or gray spots? I can't remember what it was, where there's those gray areas." And we're like, yeah, you know what that is? No, he's like, "Those are the counties that the Democrats have not contested an election and are not going to contest elections going forward." And the striking thing about it is that it was the majority of the map, right? You know, you saw this, I mean, people, this is like a cliche by this point, when people start talking about, you know, Pennsylvania is, you know, there's Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Alabama in between. Right. And there's that big T, right? Blah, blah, blah. But that is such a messed up way of thinking about like organizational politics. And this is where like Laura Putnam's piece is so important. You know, one of the things that I don't know if I use this term tonight, but she talks about it as the electorate, right? Everything is so much more fractured right now. And so you're seeing these kind of municipal gains, like even in the kind of like red districts, red counties, if you will, there are these pockets of, there might be around towns, there might be around cities, there might be around universities, right? There might be around hospitals, right? That are these concentrated Democratic areas, right? And for the longest time, those folks are just kind of left out in the cold. Oh, well, I guess we'll vote. But now it's those same pockets, these same places in sometimes these really red districts, red counties, that we're seeing victories, right? You know, this kind of these dual directions that Laura Putnam was talking about. We're seeing that all over the place. We certainly have seen it in the Lehigh Valley, right? I mean, look what's gone on in Allentown. Look what's happened in the Lehigh Valley. You know, when that was just kind of left to the Republicans for the longest time. That's changing significantly. Blueberries. Yeah, Emily, that's exactly it. Little blueberries. I like that. So anyways, you know, for me, you know, you definitely got to check out that piece, Laura Putnam's piece, Rust Belt in Transition. And I also plug her her article in The Forge called On Postcards and Superpowers. Just fantastic pieces. And I say that, read those as in the mindset of like, this is a hopeful story, see here. And there's nothing that's kind of written in stone. And frankly, you know, when she says that the Democratic coalition, that the way the Democratic coalition is going to look going forward is not going to look the way that it used to be. And it is in this process of formation right now. That, for me, is the best possible world. And yes, it does mean that there may be some setbacks, but if the mechanics and the practical work of organizing is a muscle that has to be exercised, negotiating differences, understanding the needs of different kind of constituencies within this quote unquote Big Ten, that takes work. and practice and blunders and uncomfortable moments and discomfort. But over time, we learn. That's hopeful. And to see, you know, I to be honest with you, I'm looking forward to, you know, there's in my area, there's some new committees, Democratic committees that are coming under. It's all coming from these activists, right? From these kind of like community organizers. I'm really looking forward to getting involved with some of these committees and learning. Right? Because like, I mean, that's how incredible the work is that people are doing. And I'm thrilled to be in a position to learn. And to help, right? And to use this platform too as well in any way, you know, that I can that's gonna be productive. So pretty awesome. Anyways, wanna remind everybody that that tomorrow, if you are in the Kutztown University area, there will be a rally at 5:30 PM at the South Dining Hall at Kutztown University's campus. Kutztown University Dining Workers United are demanding that KU and Aramark recognize their union. They are the only group of dining workers in the state system of higher education without a union. And initially, they didn't want to do any big rallies and, you know, wanted to kind of hold off because it seemed like Aramark might just decide to recognize their union. And then mysteriously, there were some meetings with, you know, what I suspect are meetings between the leaders of, you know, the Aramark managers and the university administration. And then whatever conversations happened there, now Aramark has started with their, you know, captured audience meetings and sending out anti-union letters to people. And that wasn't happening before. Right? So now I have no evidence of this. I have no proof of this, right? But knowing a little bit about their administration at Kutztown University, that little kind of anti-union, that kind of anti-worker, really, or having a president or an administration who thinks that they know better than everybody else about everything else that happens on a college campus, they know how to beat COVID. It's pretend it's not there. They're willing to sell out faculty members who have, you know, just recently had a heart transplant. Tell them, hey, you know, get in the classroom or, you know, whatever. Yeah, I know you got to risk your life, but too bad for you. My hunch is that there was some strong suggestions that were coming from the Kutztown University's administration that Aramark shouldn't recognize the union. Just my thought, just my sense of things. So there was a choice, and the choice was made. And so now the counter choice is there. Rally, 5:30 in front of the South Dining Hall at Kutztown University's campus tomorrow. So, I mean, tomorrow? Yeah, tomorrow, right? Tuesday. So pretty cool. Anyways, thank you, everybody, for tuning in tonight. I hope you enjoyed the show. I was thrilled to have Laura Putnam on. I want to remind you that next week we've got a really cool show coming up. We've got Gwen Marshall's going to be on. She is an associate professor of philosophy at Florida International University. We're going to be talking about her book, this one right here, Ancestry and Culture, An Alternative to Race in 5e. And that is the fifth edition of Dungeons & Dragons. And it looks at brings to this world of tabletop role-playing games a more critical and dynamic understanding of race and culture, which is all the more important when you're in the both in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests and the kind of the ongoing, you know, kind of really important conversations we're having about race once again. And, you know, again, I've said this on the show before, but it might seem like a little bit of a niche kind of focus on Dungeons & Dragons, but what happened in the video game industry was, like, you know, the basically alt-right went in there and just kind of like dominated that whole stuff where everybody else didn't even know what was going on. to see that there's folks within the D&D community, especially with this kind of renewed interest in it, who are kind of addressing this very, very critically and looking for ways to ensure that these outdated and really exploitative and backward ways of thinking about race don't find their way into the ways that we're playing. Amy Cade said, I had several students interested in going to the rally tomorrow at Cedar Crest. Solidarity. That's fantastic. They're coming from Cedar Crest, heading out to Kutztown University to support those workers. Fantastic. That's great to hear. So yeah, do tune in next week, next Monday, November 22nd at 7 p.m. And we'll be with Gwen Marshall talking about her book, Ancestry and Culture, An Alternative to Race in 5e. I've plugged the rally multiple times tonight, but do show up at Kutztown University's South Dining Hall at 5:30 p.m. to help support the workers who are organizing their union, demand that Aramark and Kutztown University administration recognize their union. We will be back on Wednesday. Cyril and I will be back for the Wednesday show. We'll talk about his latest piece. And I know, man, Cyril's been chomping at the bit. He's got a lot of stuff going on. He's been putting a lot of stuff both in his newsletter and in his latest column, which are absolutely critical and kind of like dovetail really nicely to our discussion we had tonight. And of course, we'll be back on Friday. Sean Kitch and I will be back for our weekly politics roundup, the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. Anyways, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Man, it was a good night. Look forward to seeing y'all around. Look forward to hearing what happened at the Pembridge School District meeting tonight. And most everything else, you know, if you can, help support us. Head on over to patreon.com/rcpress and become a patron for those $5 a month. Have a good night, everybody. We'll see you later this week. See ya!